Little David Bowie, here's Golden Years.
Taking you nowhere.
Angel,
come love up, baby. Look at that sky, life's begun. Nights are warm and the days are young. Doors and pulling some strings.
Angel,
then walk luck and you looked in time. Never look back, walk tall, act fine. My sweet, don't break my heart. Doing all right, you've got to get smart. Wish upon day, I believe, oh Lord, I believe all the way.
Run for the shadows, run for the shadows, run for the shadows.
Taking you nowhere.
Angel,
come up the baby. Run for the shadows, run for the shadows, run for the shadows.
February 20th, tune in all night long for the Homelessness Marathon on CITR.
Why do a nationwide homelessness marathon?
Because homeless people should have access to the media where they can freely speak out. Because it is the homeless who are best able to educate people on the issue of homelessness.
This 14-hour broadcast will begin at sunset on Wednesday, February 20th, and continue through sunrise the next day in front of the Native Friendship Center of Montreal.
This year, more than 30 stations are carrying the Homelessness Marathon. For more info, visit www.citr.ca.
To participate, dial 1-866-763-4136. Call toll-free.
Did he say you don't want people giving you too much?
No, well, you know what? See, like, when you panhandle, people like you to come up with some clever kind of saying. And it's really unique, because every individual's got what's going to make them laugh, and you may not even understand why they're laughing.
You're listening to My Science Project on CITR 101.9 FM, and as I promised, we're going to start things off with an excerpt from a UBC alumni meeting, which was held recently. And this has actually been podcasted on the UBC website, and you can listen to more of it if you're just dying to hear the conclusion, because we're only going to play about 20 minutes of it here today. So if you want to follow up on that, you should check out www.ubc.ca/podcast. But what we have for you here is an excerpt on the aging brain, and it's given by Professor Max Sinader, who is the director of the Brain Research Center at the Vancouver Coastal Health Research Institute and at the University of British Columbia. He's also a professor of ophthalmology. He holds the Canada Research Chair in Brain Development at UBC. And his research focuses on the nature of the processing performed by the cerebral cortex, especially the sensory cortices dealing with vision and audition, and on the neural and molecular mechanisms underlying the development and adaptability of the cortex. Dr. Sinader has made important contributions to understanding the mechanisms by which we use or misuse the brain early in life and how that affects you for the rest of your life. So he is certainly in an excellent position to give advice on the aging brain. And so here for you is an excerpt from a lecture given earlier in 2007 at a UBC alumni meeting.
I'll be here this morning and talk with you a little bit about the aging brain. I'm here in my capacity as director of the Brain Research Center, which you can see behind you on this first slide. I think it's important that you as alumni have an idea of what's going on at UBC. And without sounding too arrogant, I can tell you that the UBC Brain Research Center is the best effort in Canada by a country mile, and really one of the best brain research centers in the world. And we're working hard every day to deal with the diseases of the brain, to make you learn better and age better. So today I'm going to tell you about our program called the Aging Brain. And I'll start with a quote from that well-known UBC alumnus, Leon Trotsky, who said that old age is really one of the most unexpected of the things that can happen to a person. And it does, as we know, sort of creep up on us. So let me start really with the bad news. The bad news is that we are facing, in Western societies in general, and in Canada and British Columbia in particular, a demographic epidemic of aging population. Every day, 300 people in Canada turn 65, and we expect over the next 20 years that more than a quarter of the population will be seniors. And as a result of this, we're going to have tremendous demands made on our health systems, on basically even just really on the very fabric of our society. So it's this demographic certainty that we face that has led to the creation of our Brain Research Center program called the Aging Brain. And this slide really illustrates what we're trying to achieve with this program. If we're successful, we would like to prevent the decline in memory and cognitive capacities that can occur with aging. We're going to hope to come up with better strategies to deal with neurodegenerative disorders, and I'll talk about that a little bit as we go on. And, we'd also like to have you age better if we possibly can, and we'd like to extend your life if we can. So those are the modest goals of this talk. And the other specific charge I've been given for this lecture is, you're all here, you're not students, you're here to walk away from this lecture with practical, useful information on how you can age better, age more successfully. So I'm going to, you know, from time to time, give you real advice, which hopefully you can, you know, scribble down some notes, and you can use this to change your lives. So you, I don't know whether any of you brought note paper with you, but feel free to just scribble on the materials that some of you have before you. So what's my first bit of advice? Okay, the first bit of advice for how you can age better, live longer, age more successfully. Number one, choose a good set of parents. Okay. So this slide really illustrates this bit of advice. And it makes the point that a major determinant of your longevity, and in fact your successful longevity, is your genetic heritage. You know, we can study longevity the same way we study any other trait, like, I don't know, flat feet, okay? And we can study the longevity of identical twins versus fraternal twins. We can study twins that have been reared apart versus, you know, people who've been put into the same environment but are not as closely related. And when you do all of these kinds of experiments and you assess, you know, the genetic contribution to longevity, what you find is it makes up about 30% of the variance. So we've always known that, you know, if you've got two long-lived parents, the chances are you're going to have a long life as well. And that's really what this genetic information gives you. So that's the basis of my first set of advice. Now, we know, however, that that's not all there is to it. It's not, you know, your genes may predispose, but they don't dispose. So on the previous slide, if you go back to this slide, you notice that 100 years ago, the average lifespan in the Western world was only about 50 years. Only 50 years. And now it's basically 75 and continuing to climb. So in the last 100 years, there's been absolutely no change at all in our genetics. So our genes are exactly the same as a species as they were then. But our lifespan has increased by 50%. And what that does, therefore, is point to the importance of environmental factors in basically in living well and in aging well. So let me ask you a question. Suppose you're in a situation, some of you may be close to retirement. Let's say you're a 65-year-old guy. You've worked for the last 20-odd years. You're having your retirement party. What's the single thing you'd like to know about that individual, that man, to know how long he's going to live? Hands up. Hands up if you think you know what it is. If you could only know one fact. Go ahead.
Is he married?
Is he married? Go on. Yep.
Is he a smoker?
Is he a smoker?
Is he happy?
Is he happy? Okay. Well, you're all pretty close. You're all pretty close. But actually, if there's one single predictor that is the best predictor of your longevity in this situation, and that is your income. Your income on the day you retire. If you can only know one thing. Now, the other suggestion about marriage, that's also very important, because being married, it turns out, is another very key predictor. And if you're not married, then it's like losing half your wealth. Okay, now some might say that not, you know, that being married is also about losing half your wealth. And notice I was very careful to refer to men in this discussion, because in women the correlation isn't as good, and that's because it's harder to correlate. You know, women's income is not as good a predictor of lots of other things, because women are paid in different ways than men are in our society. But in men, not being married is a big negative. For women, not being married is a mild positive. So. But really, so my second bit of advice, which you again may want to write down, is be rich. Ideally, very, very rich if you possibly can. So why is it that income is a good predictor of longevity? Well, we think that income really captures a lot of other you know, factors that are really important in successful aging, and the most important of which, I think, is being happy and avoiding stress, just as you suggested. So this all comes back to basically the aging, you know, aging and being able to get rid of your stress. So this is a study. This slide represents a study of the British civil servants. And what these people did, the Whitehall people did, was to study the death rate as a function of your rank within the British civil service. And basically what it shows is that if you're support staff, you die at a greater rate than the clerical staff. And again, the professional staff lives longer than the clerical staff, and the senior staff lives longer than all the other grades. And this is true even after you parse out all the other obvious risk factors like smoking and diabetes and heart disease and all these other things. It's just there, and it's a gradient that turns up over and over again. And we think that what this represents, why is it that people who achieve a higher rank in the civil service, live longer than people at lower ranks? It's not, you know, all of these people are at the very least middle class, so they're not starving, they're not destitute. But what we think is that the higher up in the ranks you go, the easier it is for you to delegate your stress to somebody below you in the totem pole. And we think that that's really a major determinant of longevity. Now, when we talk about stress, I'm a neuroscientist, and so we think about stress as a neural process. So what's stress all about? Well, what happens is, you know, stress has been around for a long time, and we have a well-developed stress response system in our brain. So we see a stimulus out there, I don't know, a tiger, is in the bushes, you know, a few thousand years ago, and our visual system takes in that information. It is transmitted eventually to a small part of your brain, only a couple of grams, and right in the middle, called the hypothalamus. And there, you get the stress response system kicking into action. It releases hormones, corticotrophic releasing factor, ACTH. And the net result of this is that you increase the circulation of blood to your muscles, and you run away as fast as you can. And you need that stress response system to run away from that tiger. Or you did, anyway. Nowadays, we don't have tigers. We have other kinds of stressors. But our brains are still the same. So what we've learned over the last few years is that acute stress is not bad. You know, you need that stress response system, and you've got it. You use it to catch a bus when it's running away from you. You know? But chronic stress causes a lot of problems. So in dealing with the emergency of the moment, you depress your immune system. If you chronically secrete ACTH and cortisol, which is the stress hormone secreted by the adrenal, it actually comes back to the brain and over time is toxic to brain cells. It can kill neurons. So, you know, when I'm driving across the Lions Gate Bridge on Wednesday morning and, somebody cuts me off yet again, what happens? Well, I think, oh, man, and I get a stress reaction. And what do? Well, I shunt blood to the muscles of my legs. Well, how adaptive is that? Not very. So the point is that our biology has not changed, but the stresses that we deal with have. And it's very important that we learn how to manage these stresses and we learn to avoid chronic stress. So the suggestion that you made earlier, be happy, is another suggestion that I would definitely make to you. Well, so this has sort of been bad news, I guess, mostly. But, you know, there is a simple thing that everybody in this audience can do starting tomorrow to increase their healthy longevity by up to 40%. Okay? And that's something you might not really have thought of, but it's pretty simple. You just have to eat less. So a series of studies have been performed in really several different species of animals, including mice, rats, dogs, monkeys, worms, fruit flies, you name it. in which, so a typical experiment, you take a bunch of rats and you stick them in a cage and you let them eat as much as they want. You know, they just eat and eat and eat. And then you take another bunch of rats and you give them 10% less food than the rats that are free feeding. And what you find over time is that the rats that get 10% less food live, on average, 10% longer. And they live healthy 10% longer. So then you do it with 20% less food. Now they live 20% longer. And now you do 30%, and they live 30% longer. And it sort of breaks down between about 30 and 40. This is all balanced, you know, nutritionally correct diets. But when you get to 40% less food, then it's, all right, then it's too little food. But the point is that free-feeding animals, and this applies, as I said, to cats, rats, mice, monkeys, whatever you want, and the studies are now being done in humans, although they take a long time to do, because you have to wait for humans to die, which can take a long time to do these experiments. But the experiments, the data look actually quite promising, even in humans. It does look as though eating less, eating a balanced diet, but eating less, will prolong your life. Now, we used to think that you had to start this reduced caloric intake regime early in life. And it's true that you get the best results if you start young. But you can even start old. You can start at our age. And basically, if you eat, say, 30% less food from now on, you're going to get 30% more life than you would have otherwise, is the way we think of it. So starting at any age seems to give you some benefit, but obviously the benefit is greatest if you start early in life. So this is something that is really pretty important. Now, what we're doing in our Brain Research Center is really trying to understand the biological mechanisms by which our brain ages and by which it controls our longevity, because we do believe it is the brain that ultimately controls our longevity. And what we're doing is we're using the tools of modern molecular biology to understand what is actually going on inside the brain in situations that are relevant to successful aging. So we look in the brain of animals that are calorically restricted, and we see what genes are actually turned on inside their brain. We can manipulate every gene in a model organism. What's a model organism? Well, at UBC, we have a worm bank. So we have, this may sound a little esoteric, and you may wonder what your alumni donations are going for, but they are going for this. We have a gene bank. So one of the animals we study is called C. elegans. It's a tiny little worm, and it lives about 2.5 weeks. And you can dial in any knockout you want. It's got 20,000 different genes, similar to our 25,000 human genes, and you can dial in a worm with any one of those 20,000 genes knocked out, and you can ask, how well does it learn, how well does it age, how well does it run, how well does it play basketball. You can ask any question you like out of this worm. And so we're actually able to manipulate every gene. We can either knock them out, and then it won't function, or we can do what's called an overexpression experiment. We can make it work 2 or 3 times as hard as a normal gene. And this enables us to study again, to manipulate the genetic basis. And we now have worms that will live 3, 4, 5 times as long as normal worms by manipulating various combinations of genes. And of course, the other thing we can do is we can look at the genetic variations in people who make it to, say, 100. What's the difference in the pattern of gene expression associated with their brains as opposed to people who don't make it to such, who don't live as long. Now, when you think about DNA, I want you to imagine a piano. Okay? So I think I mentioned that there are 25,000 human genes. Now, a gene is just a piece of DNA that is going to make a protein. And so I think of the human genome as being a piano with about 25,000 keys. And when a gene is active, it means that piece of DNA is busy making a protein right now. And what we've learned is that even though every cell in our body has all 25,000 genes within it, not all genes are active under all circumstances. So some genes are only active in the brain, some are only active in your big toe, some are only active in the brain when you're learning something. Some are only active when you're fighting off disease. So the way I think of it is there are particular chords on this 25,000-note keyboard that are being played under different circumstances. And what we're trying, what we now have the ability to do is to use these amazing new gene chips to actually hear the music that is being played inside the cells of your brain. So this is just a little illustration of a part of a gene chip. And actually what we're doing here is we're studying the effects of restricting caloric intake on the cells of your brain. And this is just a little part of the chip. And you see there's these little, I don't know if you can make out these little dim dots. That means those genes are not very active. Each dot represents one gene. This one's active, this one's active, this one's active, this one's active. So you can see that a small fraction of them are active. And by combining this kind of information, figuring out which genes are active, then manipulating them, going back to the worms and knocking them out or turning them up, we're basically building up a pattern of which are the biological processes that are involved in longevity. So what are the conclusions of this kind of research? Well, there's one piece of bad news. Unfortunately, oxygen is toxic. You know, they say that if oxygen were to come before the FDA today as a potentially therapeutic drug, that it would fail. And the argument would be that, well, you know, it's effective, but it's got a lot of nasty side effects, and so we can't actually approve it. And part of the problem is that oxidative metabolism results ultimately in the leakage of free radicals from your mitochondria. And that this happens worst of all, and one of the bad places it happens is in the brain. And so every breath you take hastens your death. I'm holding my breath for a second. But so basically that's what, you know, the result of these gene chip experiments and of the manipulation of the model organisms shows that manipulating genes that are involved in oxidative stress over here at the bottom will actually modulate the longevity of these lower organisms. And the other pathways that seem to be critically involved are pathways involving the repair of your DNA. There's a lot of genes that are involved in keeping your DNA healthy in the face of the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune that afflict us all. Another set of genes are related to a process called apoptosis. Apoptosis is a process by which cells in the brain commit suicide. So you may not know that you actually start out with more than twice as many brain cells as you're going to have. And a lot of them die. They commit suicide. And they commit suicide in order to help your brain tune itself up. But that's useful early in life, but then later on in life, it's not so good. So genes that are involved in cell suicide also seem to be directly related to longevity. And then insulin signaling and the processing of sugar is another area which seems to contribute in an important way to longevity. So we're hard at work sort of trying to understand how all of these processes lead not only to longevity, but to successful longevity, to a longevity free of degeneration, to a longevity of avoidance of cognitive decay, and of basically living long and prospering. So what I've done thus far is mostly talk about normal aging, but what I'd like to do is just tell you a little bit about something.
What you've just been listening to is an alumni meeting talk given by Professor Max Sinader, who's the director of the Brain Research Center here at University of British Columbia. And if you want to continue listening to this podcast or others in a similar vein, you can check out www.ubc.ca/podcast. And that's just one fine example of a lot of the really great events and talks that are going around the university here at UBC and also around in Vancouver. And so I want to give you a quick little snapshot of some other things that you could dive into. Perhaps your New Year's resolution is to include a little bit more science in your life. Maybe it's not, but nevertheless, there are a couple of great opportunities here to enjoy some talks around town. One of those is Café Scientifique, which you probably heard a lot about here on My Science Project. The next Café Scientifique takes place on January 22nd, 2008. It's a casual event held at a pub downtown, and that pub is the Railway Club. Every event is free, starts at 7:30 p.m., and includes a short talk by a guest speaker, followed by ample time for drinking beer and talking about science. On January 22nd, the featured speaker is Professor Diane Feingood of SFU. She's also the CIHR Scientific Director of the Institute of Nutrition, Metabolism, and Diabetes. And in her featured presentation at Café Scientifique, she plans to give a talk entitled "The Problem of Obesity is Not Rocket Science, It is More Complex." So that's bound to be a good one. And if you want to find out more, you can email contact@cafesci-fan.com. We've been promoting for a while now the Science World After Dark series, and it's heating back up again in 2008. It's an event for adults only where you can enjoy beer and wine and play like a kid in Science World here in Vancouver. And the next one is Friday, January 18th, so that's next Friday, from 6:30 to 10 p.m. It costs $16. There's limited tickets, but it's a great chance for you to spend an evening with adults only in Science World. Now, ongoing at Science World exhibitions right now is one called Seedy Science, and it will be open to the public until the 29th of February. I guess we're in a leap year here. And what it is an event focusing on seeds. And, of course, seeds, like people, have many interesting facets to their complex biology. And this particular exhibition looks at travel, chemistry, medicine, and industry, and all the ways in which seeds are a part of those stories. It's a traveling exhibition from the Royal Ontario Museum, and it's presented in both English and French. So that's a good one to check out, Seedy Science at Science World. And also here at UBC, there is a great community event run by the Vancouver Institute, and they have weekly events. For example, there's one on the 12th and one on the 19th, but one that I thought would be of interest to a science-y audience takes place on January 26th, and that will be a talk given by Dr. Nancy Turner from UVic. It will be held at 8:15 p.m. in Lecture Hall No. 2 of the Woodward Instructional Resources Center at UBC. And her talk is entitled "The Song of the Salmonberry Bird, Why Diversity Matters in Nature and in Culture." Dr. Turner is an ethnobotanist who has collaborated with Saanich First Nations elders to learn about the significance of plants to their culture. She's also conducted extensive research on plant classification systems among many of BC's First Nations people. And her major research contributions have been in demonstrating the pivotal role of plant resources in past and contemporary Aboriginal cultures and languages. So this should be a great talk. Again, that's on January 26th. Dr. Nancy Turner, a part of the Vancouver Institute. And there's a website that you can access easily by Googling Vancouver Institute. So there's lots of great science events at Science World, Café Scientifique, and Vancouver Institute coming up. So what I want to do now is just give a quick little musical tribute to Oscar Peterson, an amazing Canadian pianist that we lost this winter. The piece is Bag's Groove by Oscar Peterson Trio off the album Night Train. And after the song, we'll come back for the advertised trio of animal stories. Thank you. You're listening to Oscar Peterson's Bag's Groove. But I'm just going to jump in here in order to fit in our trio of animal stories in the remaining 10 minutes of the show. So what I've got here are butterflies, ants, and dinosaurs. I'm going to start things off here chatting about the butterflies. And maybe you caught whiff of the story in the news this week, or maybe you remember seeing some sort of nature documentary that described the migration patterns of monarch butterflies, but whatever, it's all really amazing. And it's not just that those little delicate monarchs make their way from here in North America to Mexico. No, that's what's old news. What's new and was published just this week in PLOS Biology is how they do it. So what it boils down to is that these monarchs have what amounts to their own built-in GPS system. And this is how it happens in butterflies. And it's not so much that they're beaming off some satellite for their positioning, but instead they're using and tracking the sunlight. As Stephen Ruppert from the University of Massachusetts Medical School has identified regulatory genes that make a migration of thousands of kilometers possible. These genes encode for molecular components of the insect's circadian clock, which allows them to plot migratory courses by synchronizing their flight pattern with the passing time as the sun moves across the sky. Now, I've identified a couple of genes, and those genes are called the cryptochrome genes. Typically, the cryptochrome genes divide into two families, cryptochrome 1, found in insects, and cryptochrome 2, found in vertebrates. But remarkably, butterflies have both. And so right there, this offers a bit of information on the evolution of these genes and circadian clocks, because it would have previously not been expected that butterflies or insects would have both. So what happens here is that there's a fascinating link between the cryptochromes and vision. Ruppert's lab has shown that pigment-producing genes in the monarch eye communicate with the butterfly's circadian clock. And in this recent report, the pathway is extended to include an area of the brain called the central complex. So altogether, this paper offers a definitive molecular and cellular set of evidence for the ability of the monarch to navigate by the sun using circadian clock and two cryptochrome genes. Now, I said I also had a little something about elephants. And I do. There's a fine balance that exists between elephants and ants and trees. Who knew? To start with, what was understood quite well was the mutually beneficial relationship between acacia trees of the African savanna and the ants that live on the trees. The tree provides the ants with nectar and hollow thorns to live in, and the ant returns the favor by aggressively attacking any animal that comes near or touches the tree. But it's not as simple as that. Todd Palmer of the University of Florida has recently demonstrated that this cozy relationship depends on grazers such as elephants and giraffes too, not just the trees and the ants on them. To look at this a bit more closely, Palmer studied 12 plots of land in Kenya. On half of these plots, large herbivorous mammals had been fenced out for the past 12 years. On the other half, it was business as usual, elephants, giraffes, oh plenty. So in plots without herbivores, the trees produce less nectar and fewer thorns, presumably because in the absence of herbivores, these trees need less protection from the ants, therefore are less likely to need to provide the ants with food and housing. So the absence of grazing animals, however, was actually indirectly damaging the trees. First of all, the protective species of ants, known as Chromatogaster mimosi, was 30% less common on trees in these plots, and it was replaced by a second ant, C. jostedi, which harms the trees by encouraging attack by a stem-boring beetle. So as a result, trees on the plots lacking herbivores grew more slowly and were more likely to die. Even the so-called protecting species, C. mimosi, becomes less useful due to the lack of food and housing. It stops attacking its invaders. So this study is just one sobering example of the fine balance within ecosystems that is threatened by encroaching habitats. The effects of expanding human settlements on large animals are well documented, but the ripple effects on conservation of ecosystems, ants and trees in this instance, are a loud wake-up call. And finally, a pretty hot little bit of news that was covered all over the papers this week was about dinosaurs and dinosaur skins. In a recent publication of the Royal Society Journal called Proceedings B, evidence is presented to suggest that the plant-eating dinosaur, known as the Psittacosaurus, had a thick layer of shark-like skin hidden underneath scales or feathers. Historically, it's been pretty difficult to figure out what dinosaur skin looked like. Our researchers have debated over several possibilities, including whether dinosaur skin might include primitive feathers or scales. But recently, in China, the Psittacosaurus specimen was uncovered, and this particular fossil had the skin folded such that a cross-section was visible. This cross-section of dinosaur skin suggests that the Psittacosaurus, also known as the parrot lizard, had a tough, scaly skin of about 25 layers, similar to what you'd see today on a shark or a reptile or a dolphin. Moreover, the skin fossil, the skin on the fossil exhibited signs of tooth marks, and the bones were broken in such a way as to suggest that it was attacked by another dinosaur before being rapidly covered by sediment, allowing it to be preserved for our discovery today. So that just about wraps it up for today. The final little bit of trivia that I want to leave you with is a recent discovery of my own here, and that's that radish skins can be used as an acid or base indicator. So if you want to try this one at home, go buy yourself some fresh radishes. Rub a number of solutions onto an index card and then rub the radish over that spot, and you can observe the color changes. If you choose an obvious acid such as vinegar, when you rub the radish over top, you'll see that it retains a red color, but if you choose an obvious base such as household ammonia, you'll see that it turns blue. So you can have some good times in your kitchen with that. And to say goodbye, I'm going to leave you with a Dinosaur Junior tune, and coming up next is Darren with Stereoscopic Readout. Thanks for listening to my science project. Julie will be here on the 24th.
I know we're